The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Vadim Gluzman, the outstanding young Israeli violinist widely regarded as one of the best violinists in the world. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, Israel correspondent Rabbi David Wilfon from Jerusalem, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com. or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been on the event circuit the last week or so. Dinners and lunches and public commemorations and celebrations to honor people and raise money for all the many important Jewish charities. Many. This is something that happens in the spring and fall, periods when, as a congregational and community rabbi, you literally find yourself going from a hotel ballroom to another one for one cause after another, delivering invocations or benedictions or singing hatikvah or just shaking lots of hands and making a great deal of small talk with prominent people in your community. There are some advantages to this kind of charitable event period. You never have to worry about where your next meal will come from, because they always feed you, although usually not very well. I mean, how good can hotel possibly taste the third day in a row? But anyway, dessert is usually pretty tasty. And you do get to see a lot of the same people again and again and again and again and again. Okay, maybe that's not an advantage. Just to give you an example, last weekend I attended a community event as a guest Saturday night, officiated at a large funeral Sunday morning, hosted and spoke and sang and conducted a choir at a Yom HaShoah Holocaust event at our Temple Emmanuel Sunday afternoon, and spoke and sang at another fundraiser early Sunday evening, all in about 24 hours. The events in question range from a banquet honoring a friend of mine for a Jewish day school, to the Yom HaShoah Memorial Commemoration of the Holocaust, to an annual dinner for AIPAC, the National Pro-Israel Lobbying Group. And later last week, I did an invocation for a Red Cross event, and my temple hosted a special service and dinner and program honoring our associate rabbi, Ben Scharf, an occasional newsman here on Too Jewish who is going out on his own to his congregation in Baltimore. Well, tonight I have an Israeli Memorial Day program, and Tuesday an Israeli Independence Day program, and then graduations and confirmation and a retreat and... Whew! Anyway, for all of the hectic quality of this time of year, there are some compensations. One is hearing from interesting speakers, sometimes, who are brought in to highlight these events and bring a little extra attendance and, you know, funds. So, this past week, I heard from two very interesting, very different Jewish journalists. One, Jeffrey Goldberg, is the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of a book on his time as a prison guard for the Israeli Defense Forces in the West Bank. Another speaker was Dan Senor, co-author of the book Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle, which highlights aspects of Israeli society that have made the small, resource-poor country a phenomenal business success in the 21st century. Both of these guys, by the way, are fine speakers. Jeff Goldberg is much funnier, Dan Senor is perhaps a bit smoother and definitely richer. And both are relatively young men who have already accomplished a good deal. Both speakers strongly support Israel. Both are literate Americans with strong ties to New York, and both understand Israel well. What was really interesting as we approach Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, this week, is the very different perspective they gave on just what Israel is today. Goldberg, an ardent Zionist who made Aliyah and served in the army, forged strong connections with a variety of Palestinian prisoners in the IDF prison camp he guarded during his time in the Israeli military. He painted a complex picture of the humanity on both sides of the barbed wire. While most of us try to avoid people who'd like to wipe us out, Jeff Goldberg goes right up to them and introduces himself. He talked about the unusual friendship he struck up when he was a guard with a devout prisoner named Rafik. He talked about Hamas and Fatah, about Islamic fundamentalism and the real people who are attracted to it, about the complexity and difficulty of making peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Jeff Goldberg, an inherently optimistic guy, is not sanguine about the prospects for permanent peace with Palestinians, or for that matter, about the future of the Palestinians as a nation or a people. What a complex situation this is for Israel, tied inextricably to the Palestinians by geography. Dan Senor, on the other hand, listed all the problems Israel faces as an economic unit, a tiny country in a region in which 21 of the 23 nearby countries will not have trading relationships with it. It has virtually no regional markets, can't transport anything by land anywhere else. Israel is a country without natural resources to speak of, with a shortage even of water. A country with a workforce made up of people born in 150 different countries, very few of whom came with any knowledge of its language of business, Hebrew. Israel is a country that imports virtually all its energy, has been subject to constant war, terror, and economic boycott throughout its 61-year history. And yet, that same young country, Israel, is the worldwide center for high-tech business innovation. Although there are just 7 million Israelis, Israel has produced more companies listed on the NASDAQ stock exchange of high-tech companies than any country outside the U.S. It's third in the world in the development of software after America and India, first in the development of computer security systems. It's at the cutting edge of social networking sites, and the multinational high-tech firms Intel and Microsoft consider their Israeli locations to be the place where the toughest problems are solved. Dan Senor highlighted what it is about Israeli society that makes it possible for this kind of business vitality to flourish, a culture of questioning inherited from Jewish tradition, Talmud, and rabbis, an army that teaches all young people how to lead and innovate in fluid situations from the time they're just 18 years old, a close relationship between the innovation necessary for military success against the odds and a business community that's always looking for the next major advance and that constantly thinks entrepreneurially, and the permission to fail, pick yourself up, and try again. As we approach the 61st anniversary of Israel, we celebrate the extraordinary diversity of this country and the dynamic quality of the contrast that is at the heart of the Israeli experience. Both the challenge and the innovation are at the heart of Israeli life. To prepare us for Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day, here's Shuli Natan singing Al Kol Ela, the great Naomi Shemer's song, for the honey and the thistle, for the bitter and the sweet, for all these things, God, we thank you.
Al hadvash ve'al ha'oketz, al hamar ve'hamatok, al biteinu ha'tinoket shmor eili. Shmur al ha'me'ad she. יש לי על האור ועל הטף על הפרי שלא הבשיל עוד ושנאסף על כל אלה על כל אלה שמור נא לי אלי אטום על הדבש ועל העוקץ על המר והמתוק על נטע קור נטוע אל תשכח את התקווה השיבני והשוב נושר כוכב משאלות ליבי בחושך נרשמות עכשיו אנא שמור לי על כל אלה ועל אהובי נפשי על השקט על הבכי ועל זה השיר על כל אלה
That was Israeli singer Shuli Natan, a former guest of Two Jewish, singing Al Kol Eila in honor of Israeli Independence Day this week, Monday night and Tuesday. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest this morning will be the delightful violinist Vadim Gluzman, who just might be the best violinist in the world right now. A young man with a fascinating history and an unusually articulate and interesting way of explaining it. We'll meet Vadim Gluzman in a few moments right here on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, one of the fastest rising and really spectacular violinists in the world, Vadim Gluzman. Born in 1973 in the Ukraine, he began studying the violin at the ripe age of seven. Before moving to Israel in 1990, he studied under Zachar Bron and then later under Yair Kless in Tel Aviv. He also studied in the United States under Arkady Fomlin and at the Juilliard School. Early in his career, he enjoyed the encouragement and support of Isaac Stern. In 1994, Vadim Gluzman received the prestigious Henrik Sering Foundation Career Award. He plays a 1690 Stradivarius on extended loan to him. How does it feel to play an instrument that's worth more than most people's homes?
Well, there is a wonderful organization in Chicago called the Stradivari Society. And what they do, they find people who can buy such instruments, and then they match them with people who can actually play them.
Right.
And I'm one of the lucky ones.
You really are. I've had the privilege of hearing, although only on recording so far, some of your work, and you have an extraordinary talent. You've been compared to Yasha Heifetz and Isaac Stern himself. How do those comparisons feel to you?
I'm humbled, honestly, to be compared to my idols, so to speak, is a great honor, of course. And all I can say, I try to live up to it.
It seems that there is. There are tastes and trends in violin, as well as there are in everything else in society, and that a certain style of playing, maybe a more dramatic or modern style, had become more popular. You really represent a more classical approach. Is that a fair statement or not?
I really don't like putting labels on things, be it music or anything else for that matter. Classical, romantic, modern, or old-fashioned, I don't know. I do know that I feel very much connected to the music making of the past. I do feel very much connected to the what was called the gold generation of soloists, likes of Yasha Heifetz, like Isaac Stern, like David Oistrakh, etc. These were people that I grew up listening to, and somehow that way of expression, that way of singing on the violin is something that is very close to my heart, but I would not really call it modern or old-fashioned for that matter.
We will hear more from Vadim Gluzman, who does make the violin sing, when we come back a little bit on Too Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows through the website, or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. You have heard from our guest Vadim Gluzman, but you really can't appreciate him until you hear what he can do on the violin. Here's some of the wonderful Baal Shem Suite by Ernest Bloch, a bit of Simchas Torah in April from Vadim Gluzman.
Thank you.
Violinist Vadim Guzman combines astonishing technique, every note seems perfect, with a glorious tone on the violin. Frankly, I've heard Isaac Stern and Pinchas Zuckerman and many other outstanding violinists, most of them Jewish, of course, but Guzman might be the best I have ever heard in person. We welcome our special correspondent from Israel, Rabbi David Wilfond, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Good morning, Gingy.
Boker tov, Sam.
Boker or. Well, two important events tonight and then the day after, Yom HaZikaron, the Memorial Day for fallen Israeli soldiers tonight and tomorrow, and then Yom HaTzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, right after that. Can you talk about those holidays in Israel? They certainly mean more there than anywhere else.
These 2 days are what I would call the secular high holy days of Israeli society. These are extremely, extremely important days, and they come one right immediately before the other. Yom HaZikaron is the Memorial Day, and not to sound glib, but it is not a day for white sales or special bargains at the mall. Memorial Day is really a day of mourning and of memory. Israel has lost about 20,200 soldiers in order that the country can survive. It was 1%. There were 600,000 people in Israel in 1948. It was begun, and 6,000 were killed. So that was 1%. But it's many more today. Every family is touched. There's not a family that didn't lose someone or lose a neighbor. And so what happens is, it begins at sunset with the lighting of Yahrzeit candles at a national ceremony at Mount Herzl. The following morning at 11 o'clock, and 11 is kind of symbolic because the two ones represent the two legs standing at attention of a human being. And so at 11 o'clock, a siren will go off. It lasts for 2 minutes. It's heard throughout the country, and everything will come to a halt. Buses, taxis, drivers on the highway, everything stops. People get out and they stand in silence, listening to the siren, lowering their heads, and remembering those who have died that the country could exist. People go and visit the cemeteries. They visit families for whom this is the Yahrzeit time of their loved one. And then at sunset, the country goes to a jolting transition to the day of Yom HaAtzmaut, the Independence Day, the birthday of the country. And the idea is you can't celebrate the joy without first acknowledging the price. And so we have this very somber acknowledgement, but then Yom HaAtzmaut is a day of unparalleled joy, a day of creativity. There are festivals and parades in Jerusalem, where I live, each year. One neighborhood is chosen to be kind of like a showcase neighborhood where they will do a historical thing. People put on costumes of what was this neighborhood like in the 1880s or the 1920s. And it's just a day of happiness and joy, and a day in which we look towards the future. What kind of Israel also would we like to become?
You know, it's remarkable. I think of the Naomi Shemer song, Al Kolela, Al Hadvas, Al Haoketz, for the honey and the thorn, for the bitter and the sweet. You have one right before the other in Israel. Remarkable period of time. Thanks, David. We will talk next week.
Be well. And Chag Ha'atzmaut Sameach.
Chag Ha'atzmaut Sameach. We welcome our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Yom HaTzmaut is, this week, Israeli Independence Day, one of the unsung American Jewish holidays, but huge in Israel and important here in its own way. Brings up the whole question of independence and freedom.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting thing that you say it's an unsung holiday here, because it is such a powerful holiday in Israel. I'll never forget the first time in 1974 that I was able to experience the combination of,
Yom HaZikaron.
Exactly. The remembrance of the fallen soldiers and the dead, and then the beautiful moment of celebration, and how he would find people in the street just, hours before who had been mourning, celebrating and cherishing their freedom and their independence in the land of Israel. And, we just finished with Pesach, our Passover holiday, which something that we don't tend to think about is the freedom and independence we have to celebrate holidays, ranging from everything from Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut, like we do this weekend, to Pesach and Shavuot, which is coming up. Which brings me to a concept that I think we don't relate freedom and independence to, which is the calendar. You know, the notion of the calendar, the Jewish calendar, the first month actually being Passover, troubles a lot of people. They always think, well, it should really be Rosh Hashanah. That's the beginning of the Jewish New Year, the creation of the world. Why do we start the count from Pesach? And, of course, it's, you know, historically tied to the first emergence of the Hebrew people becoming a Jewish nation. But even more significantly, I think, it's the notion that when we are slaves or when we are really encumbered by other nations or under the thumb of dictators or other foreign rule, our time is not our own. We don't really get to call the shots. You don't get to say, gee, I think I'll go out for a cup of coffee, because you are enslaved. And really, one of the magnificent things about being a free people in a free country in America, and of course for Jews in Israel, is that we get to celebrate and call the time our own, and the calendar, and being able to determine the use of our time is really a privilege of being a free, independent people. And so I think it's something we should really be not take for granted, because it has not always been this way that Jews were able to have time be at their disposal in a way that they wanted to shape it.
So in a way, this ability to celebrate any holiday
exactly
becomes a reminder of freedom.
Exactly.
Good reminder, good thing to think about as we enter Yom HaAtzmaut. Thanks, Amy. We will talk next week.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant on the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
I think the most special meal in all of Arizona is a dinner at Janos.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. I tell you, I'm really proud of it. We have so much fun. That's what Janos is all about. Special foods, special people, special occasions, but really using the best products available to us and really taking the time and crafting wonderful, wonderful, beautiful, and perfectly executed food.
My wife calls it, I think I've told you this before, magic food. It's just, you can't believe that it can taste quite the way it does.
No, that's nice of you to say. Well, I'll tell you, we really have a lot of fun doing it, and the flavors we use are really, really terrific. The service is great, and so we're just proud of what we do and love having people come in for dinner.
For an outstanding restaurant experience, the phone number for Janos.
615-6100. You can go online, www.janos.com.
For the best meal in all of Southern Arizona.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, there was a tragic plane accident last week. The president of Poland, Kaczynski, I think is his name, who had made a variety of overtures to the Jewish community, was the first Polish head of state to attend services in a synagogue. It happened in Warsaw in 2008. Has come to Israel, built a lot of bilateral ties there. A lot of very positive thoughts about him, and then suddenly he's gone. Maybe we could talk about Poland today. It's a place where a lot of people's ancestors came from. We don't think about it very much as a Jewish place today.
All true, and it was a very sad incident, full of historic ironies. The cream of Polish government, business, military, society were going to visit the scene of a horrific massacre of an earlier generation of the cream of Poland, the flower of Polish manhood, at the hands of Soviet military and secret police. I don't know, 60, 70 years ago in a place called Katyn. And it was something that traditionally the Soviets denied, the Russians after them denied, but they finally acknowledged. And it was a roadblock, one of many, standing in the way of better Polish-Russian relations. And when the Russians removed this and the flower of Poland all got in a presidential aircraft to fly there and pay homage to this site, the plane crashed under disputed circumstances, at the very least. The Russians claimed that the air traffic controller advised the captain several times, don't land, there's bad weather, there's no visibility, you're off the glide path, abort your landing, whatever. And the Polish captain refused to listen, is the Russian version. And the Polish version is the captain knew that there were some visibility problems, but made an informed decision to land anyway, and who knows what really happened. I mean, we're north of the Balkans, but just barely, and so no death is natural, no plane crash is natural, and in the long, very troubled history of Polish-Russian relations, nothing like this is ever going to be taken lightly or naturally. Now, in terms of Poland and the Jews, you made an interesting comment that many American Jews have forebears from Poland, and part of the problem with that statement is, like, you know, when people say, oh, my family comes from Romania, or my family comes from Ukraine, or my family comes from Russia, the borders were so fluid over the centuries. At one point, Poland stretched from the Baltic to the Black Sea and was a huge power in Eastern and Central Europe. And at another point, for several centuries, it completely disappeared from the map because it was partitioned among, many people mistakenly think, between Germany and Russia. No, it was among three powers: the Germans, the Russians, and the Austro-Hungarians, who controlled Krakow and a good chunk of southeastern Poland, part of which now belongs to Ukraine. So when we say we're from Poland, we're not necessarily speaking about the Poland that appears on the map today. But the Poland that does appear on the map today is an important country, probably the most populous or very close to the most populous country in the European Union, and a country with an important Jewish community, past, present, and possibly also future, which we should talk about next week.
We will do so. Thanks very much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. They were discussing whales in elementary school, and one little girl said, in the Bible, a whale swallowed Jonah. Her teacher answered, it was physically impossible for a whale to swallow a human, because even though it's a very large mammal, its throat is very small. The little girl repeated that a whale swallowed Jonah. Irritated, the teacher reiterated, a whale could not swallow a human, it was physically impossible. The little girl said, well, when I get to heaven, I will ask Jonah. Still irritated, the teacher asked, what if Jonah went to hell? The little girl replied, then you ask him. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Can you tell I've been fishing for new jokes? And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Achrimot Kedoshim, which includes the Code of Holiness, a description of the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. The Code itself has mitzvot that require us to assist the poor, treat the strangers, widows, and orphans among us with generosity and kindness, insist on fair business practices, and obligate us to moral lives. It's important that this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kedoshim, the holiness code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of our most sacred text. And at that heart is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. It's an amazing and perhaps utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. But if our society were actually rooted in such a conception, how much better it would be for everyone. In true Jewish fashion, however, this is not simply an idealistic statement. It's instead made a practical imperative. Achremot Kedoshim builds up to this magnificent religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and the stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and the orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical because that is the heart of holiness. Interestingly, the central statement to love your neighbor follows a commandment to correct your neighbor when he sins, to reproach and not keep hatred in your heart. In Jewish terms, true love must be rooted in honesty. Without that, it is meaningless. With honesty, love is the most profound and holiest emotion of all. And with honesty and love, true holiness can emerge. May Kedoshim remind us of our obligation to love and to do so honestly. When we come back on To Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk more with our outstanding and very entertaining guest, Vadim Gluzman, the great Russian-Israeli violinist. Find out more of his extraordinary story when we come back on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The new president of the renowned deaf university, Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., is Jewish. T. Allen Hurwitz, who is what's called profoundly deaf, became the 10th president of Gallaudet last week and its first Jewish president. As one article put it, sign language is his mama lotion. Hurwitz was president of the National Technical Institute for the Deaf in Rochester, New York. In an interview, he noted that, like there are different levels of Judaism, reform, conservative, the same holds true for the deaf and hard of hearing community. There are lots of different approaches, but there continues to be a fundamental common thread that crosses those differences. It turns out that all four of the finalists for the presidency of Gallaudet were Jewish. Mazel tov to Dr. Hurwitz on his new position as head of the historic deaf college, Gallaudet. Now I wonder, which movement was the president talking about in Judaism that would qualify as profoundly deaf? With the coming retirement of Justice John Paul Stevens from the U.S. Supreme Court, two Jewish women are apparently on the short list to receive nomination for that appointment, Solicitor General Elena Kagan and Judge Merrick Garland. Currently, two of the nine justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, are Jewish. If either Kagan or Garland are appointed, and supposedly there are only three judges on the short list, all women, by the way, this would make the High Court one-third Jewish and two-thirds Catholic, with no Protestant justices for the first time in American history. Wow, that's kind of astounding. I realize that most people will not even notice this fact, but it is yet another sign of the essential acceptance of Jews and Judaism in American society. I am more shocked that there might be no Protestants on the Supreme Court of a country that is roughly, very roughly, 53% Protestant than that one-third of that court might turn out to be Jewish, although we are maybe 2% of the population. Iran has succeeded in producing its first significant batch of further enriched uranium, the country's nuclear chief, Ali Akbar Salehi, said last week, a move that defies UN demands to halt the controversial program. The uranium has been enriched from around 3.5% to 20% purity. That's what's needed to fuel a medical research reactor, Salehi said. That level is far below the more than 90% needed to build a nuclear weapon. But U.S. officials have expressed concern Iran is moving closer to the ability to reach weapons-grade level. Washington is now accelerating its campaign for a new round of U.N. sanctions against Iran for its refusal to suspend enrichment as demanded by the U.N. Salehi's announcement was a sign of Tehran's further determination to push ahead with this program. Tehran began the further enrichment in February after talks stalled over a U.N.-brokered proposal that the U.S. hoped would at least temporarily leave Iran unable to produce a warhead. The U.S. and its allies, including, of course, Israel, accuse Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon, a claim Iran unconvincingly denies. Under the proposal, Iran was supposed to send about 2,400 pounds of low-enriched uranium abroad, where it would be further enriched to 20%, converted into fuel rods, which would then be returned to Iran for use in the research reactor. That would leave Iran with insufficient low-enriched uranium to further purify to weapons-grade level. Ah, but Iran made counter-demands on the deal that the U.S. and its allies rejected, saying they would thwart the goal of the swap. In any case, Iran says a nuclear fuel swap with the West, as proposed by the UN, is still on the table, saying there was tacit agreement on the amount and timing, but the two sides need to talk on where. The U.S. is working to gather support at the UN for a new round of sanctions against Iran for its refusal to suspend enrichment entirely, as demanded by the United Nations. Salehi's announcement was a sign Iran is determined to go ahead with its nuclear program. This is Israel's greatest strategic concern today in the entire world. And Israelis are mourning the tragic death of Polish President Lech Kaczynski, who died in a plane crash in Russia last week. He was considered a true friend to Israel, who worked to dramatically improve ties between Poland and Israel, and also helped to work to heal the scars of the Shoah, the Holocaust. In 2008 in Warsaw, Kaczynski became the first head of state of Poland to attend services at a Polish synagogue. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the news of Jews round the world. We welcome back our guest this morning, the outstanding violinist Vadim Gluzman, who has created a tremendous international reputation at the age of 37. He was born in the Ukraine, moved to Israel at the age of 16, studied there, and then at the Juilliard School and with others in America. He enjoyed the encouragement and support of Isaac Stern early in his career, has received prestigious awards, plays a fantastic Stradivarius, and we're delighted to have you back. Good morning again.
Good morning.
So you studied with Jewish violinists in the Ukraine and, of course, in Israel. Everybody always used to talk about the violin as the Jewish instrument. Do you think that's true?
Of course it is. I think I would be a fool being Jewish myself, not to say yes to that question. But seriously, historically, violin has been a Jewish instrument. Fiddle is something that we've been playing for centuries, ever since Baal Shem Tov came around and the klezmer tradition began. Fiddle became a very important part of Jewish life, and every celebration or even mourning was with some instruments in hand, and violin was one of the main ones, of course.
Violin and clarinet are the two that always come to mind.
Absolutely, and my father is a clarinetist.
Of course.
I played clarinet, but not really. Not the way you guys play. Does that make the violin too Jewish as an instrument?
No, I don't think anything can be too Jewish. Actually, that was the question I wanted to ask you, as strange as it may be. You're the one asking questions. But how can one be too Jewish?
God bless you. It's exactly the right question. You know, that's always what we've explored here, because for so long in Judaism, in America, the idea is you could be Jewish but not too Jewish. And I've always questioned that whole concept. And part of what we do on this show is explore it, because for some people it's okay to be Jewish but not too Jewish. Of course, as a rabbi, I don't accept that, but it's fun to talk about it.
Well, as a violinist, I don't either.
Good. Then we are in complete solidarity.
Absolutely. Can one be too Italian?
No.
Or too Filipino?
I'm going to get into so much trouble here if we keep going down this course.
To American?
To anything.
Anything. Yeah.
If you get into trouble, blame me.
Okay. Please. I promise.
You are young for a great violinist, and classical music in America has a reputation of the occupancy of older patrons, and that the audience is getting older. Do you find that to be true? And how do you explore spreading great classical music to people who are not, shall we say, past their prime?
To your first question, I do find it to be true, and no, I do not. For decades, classical music has been patronized by one could say, older audience. I do see my friends with whom I grew up together since we were kids, who are not musicians, and we had an understanding that they really don't care about classical music, and they would never go to my concerts. And I never had a problem with it. I love people not because they go to my concerts or not. That is silly. And then suddenly, little by little, I see them show up. And I'm not even inviting them. I know it's not part of their, it's not on their radar, so to speak. And I see them show up here and show up there and then call and then come back and say, hey, I liked it. I'm coming back. I think it's a matter of age as well. Appreciating classical music may simply come a little later in life. Which is absolutely, I see absolutely no problem with it. Having said that, the audience are shrinking, and that's something that I really think we as musicians should pay attention to and try to help the situation. And there is, I think, no better way than going to young people. And this is why I try to, as much as I can, meet with school children, go to schools, and then play for them in any place I go to.
You know, I remember having classical musicians come to play for me in school, but I think that hasn't happened for my children, and I hope that it's the kind of thing that we can continue to develop.
I think this is unfortunate.
Yeah. I used to pass by the Reuben Academy of Music in Jerusalem when I walked to rabbinical school.
Israel.
I know exactly where you studied.
Yes.
You record a variety, I mean, you play many, many composers, you record a variety of composers. I have a wonderful recording of yours of Leonard Bernstein's Serenade and the Bloch Baal Shem. Do you have particular composers that you love to play?
No, I think it would be unfair, and I would quote a great Arturo Toscanini, the mm-hmm. conductor.
Conductor.
Who
was not too Italian, really. He was...
No, God, no. we're not starting this.
No, we won't start that again. I'm sorry.
But there were probably not too many that were more Italian than him, just to make sure. he used to say a wonderful line to this question, that his favorite conductor was the one he plays tonight.
Yes.
And I think this is honest. For a musician, if I would announce today that such and such is my favorite composer, that means that X, Y, and Z I will simply play not as well.
Not as well, right.
And I think that would be a pity. So I do have some composers that I do not play. And I do not play them not because I don't think highly of them, but because I simply don't feel connection.
Who don't you play?
I do not play Paganini. I do not play Paganini for these are my own meshuggah, but I find it silly to spend my hours of practicing for simply technical things, running up and down the fingerboard and playing thousands of notes per square inch without feeling a musical message. And that's the way I feel in Paganini, and I by no means do I say that this is the truth about Paganini. It's just the way I feel. Therefore, since I don't feel I have something to say, I will not play. And there are pieces that here and there that I chose not to play for different reasons. But to say that there is a favorite composer, no. Every piece that is in my repertoire, I feel deeply connected to every piece that I play. I believe wholeheartedly, and I hope it somehow shows in my performance.
It's a great passion. You have really an extraordinary tone. I mean, I'm not an expert. I've heard a lot of good violinists, but there's a depth to your tone. Do you feel that there's something special? Is it something that one can work on and cultivate, or does it just emerge from your overall skill?
Well, if I may please shift the focus of this to someone else, not to myself. I think tone is a reflection of who we are. The sound that we produce, and it's true, I think, to every instrument or voice. This is the real, I think, window to one's soul.
We would say the ikar of the individual. In
exactly, the, exactly.
The root, the soul, the heart.
Yeah. And so if we look at it from this perspective, no, you cannot work on it. This is what we have. Yet, of course, there are technical aspects that can help one to show and to reflect exactly what you want. And there is a more important subject, and this is inner hearing. And this is something one can work on. This is something that one can develop. Without a clear idea of the tone that you want to produce at any given moment, you will never be able to produce it. And this is something that every musician, I think, has to develop in him or herself, this ideal hearing of that tone, that voice, that sound that I want to strive for. And then the next problem is, of course, getting there.
So first, understanding what the tone is, what the ideal is, and then accomplishing it.
Absolutely. Of course, it would be silly to say first you do this and then you do that. It's a process that we
evolve.
You live with, you grow with, you hopefully evolve with.
I want to thank Vadim Gluzman, the extraordinary violinist, for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish, and I encourage you to seek out his recordings and his performances. Thank you, Vadim.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear from next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Sean Landris, an innovator in web-based business and music production, founder of a record label, and the Jewish music website, Jumpstart. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from our guest, Vadim Gluzman. It's Bloch's Baal Shem Tov Suite, another delightful flavor of this great violinist's playing. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Thank you.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.